Interested in the forces shaping our world? The Council on Foreign Relations has you covered. For those who like to look ahead, dive into The World Next Week, hosted by Bob McMahon and Carla Ann Robbins.
We were not forecasting anything about Russian domestic upheaval, and yet that has been the story of the week.
These were scorpions going after each other in a bottle.
And for those who want to go beyond the headlines, join Jim Lindsay as he opens up the president's inbox.
What should U.S. policy do?
The approach towards China, it's enough to make me question bipartisanship.
And finally, join me, Gabrielle Sierra, on Why It Matters, as my guests and I bring some of the world's most compelling stories home to you.
Do you feel good about where we're heading with AI?
Maybe we need to invent a new word here, which kind of is a combination of frightened and excited.
I'm
excited.
So what are you waiting for?
For the world next week.
The President's Inbox.
And Why It Matters. We'll see you soon.
In Haiti, violent criminal gangs are making it nearly impossible for people just to go about their daily lives.
You plan your day knowing that it may be the last time that you are able to go out and knowing that you may not come back home alive. It's that bad.
Some say the only solution for Haiti is foreign intervention. Also on the show, in Pakistan, a new law would punish parents who don't get their kids vaccinated. Experts are not so sure it'll work.
Forcing parents or sending parents to jail does not solve the problem.
I'm Marco Werman, and leaders in one Midwestern U.S. city are hoping to entice immigrants to come work there, offering to pay them thousands of dollars to relocate.
Sometimes we have to sweeten the pot a little bit to get people to consider us.
All those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us this Tuesday. It will be a massive challenge, but international security forces are expected to deploy to the Caribbean nation of Haiti. The one-year peacekeeping mission will be led by Kenya. On Monday, the United Nations Security Council voted to approve the intervention. Here's U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the UN, Jeffrey De Laurentiis.
This mission comes at the request of the Haitian government and Haitian civil society to address the insecurity and dire humanitarian crisis the country has faced for far too long.
At the heart of the problem are violent criminal gangs that control much of Haiti. The World's TV Saizea begins our coverage.
On her way to work, Velina Charlier frequently sees dead bodies lying on the streets of Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti.
Gang violence has become our day-to-day. You plan your day knowing that it may be the last time that you are able to go out and knowing that you may not come back home alive. It's that bad.
Charlier is an anti-corruption activist in Haiti, and she says she's particularly concerned about her four young daughters.
Because you face the risk of being kidnapped. And most of the time, if a woman gets kidnapped, they get gang raped. So the kids are basically on house arrest. They don't go anywhere. I keep them at home.
Haiti has been facing a humanitarian crisis for decades. But Charlier says the levels of violence are unprecedented now. Armed groups are said to control much of the capital. More than 3,000 Haitians have been killed by gang violence this year alone. Hundreds of women and children have been kidnapped. And according to the World Bank, almost half of the population is living on $2 a day or less.
We are only surviving, and Haitians are dying from all different reasons.
Yesterday, responding to the news, Haiti's foreign minister said, "It's a glimmer of hope for his country." Kenya, a country with a history of sending peacekeepers to troubled countries, said it will send 1,000 police officers. Haiti's Caribbean neighbors, Jamaica and the Bahamas, have also offered to send troops. And the U.S. is adding $100 million in logistical support. Renata Segura from the International Crisis Group outlines one of the main challenges of this mission.
You have living in the same place gangs and civilians, one next to each other. That is going to be a logistical problem for the troops coming, right?
She also says Port-au-Prince doesn't have good urban planning and is full of difficult terrain. Another challenge could be the language barrier, as the troops would come from English-speaking countries. But at this point, Segura says, there is no better option.
An international intervention is certainly the only way in which the spiral of violence in Haiti is going to stop.
But Haiti has a complicated history of international interventions.
We have been seeing interventions in Haiti since 1994. Obviously, this is not working.
That's Velina Tallier again.
What we have seen in the past is that whenever the mission leaves, the insecurity becomes worse than it was before.
The last time that the UN was present in the country, there was a scandal over sexual misconduct. Also, the peacekeeping mission introduced cholera by mistake into Haiti's water source. The outbreak killed thousands of Haitians. Juan Gabriel Valdez, the current ambassador of Chile to the United States, participated in a previous UN mission in Haiti. He says the fact that there is no one single elected official left in Haiti might be an added challenge for this mission.
If you don't have a Haitian legitimate government that will authorize the use of force by foreign troops in the field, it's a serious problem.
He says there needs to be progress both on the military and the political side. Todd Robinson, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, was optimistic in a recent conversation at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C.
The Kenyans have stepped up to lead this thing, but we will expect other countries to step up, either in kind, with equipment, or financially. The United States is committed to making this mission a success.
He says they will provide intelligence support that specializes in criminal networks. And with that, he says the mission will be a successful first step to bringing peace to Haiti. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
It was supposed to be an ordinary soccer match with loud support for the local team. Iranian fans in the city of Isfahan cheered for home club Sepahan before a recent kickoff. The visiting team was Al Ittihad from Saudi Arabia, but the game never happened. The Saudi team didn't even leave the visitors' locker room. The match was abruptly canceled. To hear about how this Iran-Saudi Arabia soccer match became a victim of foreign relations, we're joined by Kristen Diwan. She's an expert with the Arab Gulf States Institute based in Washington. Kristen, why was this match called off?
Well, you're right. There was a large crowd there excited to see these two teams playing in the Asian Champions League. But it seems that the Iranians had placed several busts of the late militant leader of the Al-Quds Force, Qasem Soleimani, along the entranceway that the Saudi players would have to walk by.
Remind us about Qasem Soleimani. Who was he and what was he known for?
Yeah, he was the head of the Iranian elite Al-Quds Force. He was killed by a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January 2020. And he was responsible, really, for organizing a lot of the different Iran-linked militias abroad. And so, obviously, had been involved in a lot of actions that were detrimental to Saudi Arabia's interests in the region and U.S. interests, we can say that as well.
Yeah, I mean, Iran and Saudi Arabia came together this summer, China brokering this diplomatic deal between two longtime rivals. It was supposed to be a fresh start. What do you think this episode tells us about the state of Saudi-Iranian relations right now?
We know that Saudi Arabia is really focused on their economic transformation amongst this big energy transition that we're all going through. They really want things quiet so that they can work on building these new developments, which include a lot of new tourist sites, and that they want to be able then to attract a lot of foreign investment and ultimately foreign nationals to live and work in Saudi Arabia. Obviously, they can't do that if they've got, you know, Iranian drones bombing their oil facilities, attacking their oil facilities, or missiles coming across from Yemen. And I guess for now, the Iranians also had determined that it was probably a good time to quiet things down a bit. They've been dealing with their own uprising at home.
Are you surprised that the Saudis were so upset by the idea of walking past these busts of Qasem Soleimani? I mean, it was, after all, the U.S. under Donald Trump that assassinated him.
No, I'm not really surprised at all. I mean, I think Soleimani was seen as a real villain across the region. And I'm sure that the Saudis saw this as a piece of manipulation that they would, you know, have to engage in that. But it does show how difficult this sort of soft diplomacy is and the number of really underlying fundamental issues that haven't been addressed between the two countries.
Saudi Arabia is said to be pursuing a diplomatic agreement with the U.S. that would lead to normalizing relations with Israel. How does that play into the Saudi-Iran relationship right now?
I think a lot of people are skeptical that they can do both of these things, you know, de-escalate with Iran and then execute an agreement with Israel at the same time. But I think it does kind of indicate the new Saudi posture, which is to try to keep kind of positive relations with everyone, to benefit where they can in each of these things, and perhaps to balance some of these conflicts off each other.
So politics rears its ugly head at a soccer match between Saudi and Iran, just as they are trying to make peace. So where do you think things go from here, Kristen?
I think it's still in the short-term interest, maybe medium-term for both of these countries to try to kind of tampen down on any sort of live disputes that they have. It's difficult, I think, to maintain those peaceful ties or de-escalated ties. But I do think there'll be efforts to do that. Well, I'm a big soccer fan, so I'm always happy to find ways to get this into my work.
Who do you follow? What's your team?
I like Arsenal in the Premier League, yeah.
Right. A lot of people love Arsenal on this side of the pond. Kristen Diwan is a senior resident scholar with the Gulf States Institute. She joined us from Washington. Great to get your take on this, Kristen. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Vaccines are only effective if people actually take them, so they have to be available. That's the first challenge. But even after they're manufactured and distributed, there's another potential challenge, and that's vaccine hesitancy. It's a problem in many parts of the globe. In one province in Pakistan, authorities are considering a new approach with parents who fail to vaccinate their children. They're actually considering locking them up. The World's Shireen Jafari reports.
This is an ad in Pakistan about the importance of getting children vaccinated against polio. Vaccine workers knock on the door of a home. A man opens but refuses to allow his son to be vaccinated. This is like pushing your child into a deep ditch, the voice in the ad says. Take a decision today if you want your child to walk tomorrow. Polio can permanently paralyze children. Vaccinations have helped eradicate the disease in most parts of the world, but not in Pakistan and Afghanistan. This week, a new vaccination drive began in Pakistan, where roughly 43 million children are unvaccinated. There's a lot of resistance from parents and guardians, especially in rural parts of the country. To counter that, authorities in Sindh province in southeastern Pakistan have put forward a bill that would fine families the equivalent of $200 if they refuse to vaccinate their children. That's almost a month's salary in Pakistan. They would also send them to jail for up to a month.
Forcing parents or sending parents to jail does not solve the problem.
Dr. Rana Javad Askar is an epidemiologist in Pakistan. He says these coercive measures will likely backfire. They might even push some parents and guardians to find other ways to avoid vaccination.
You know, people going for a fake marks on their fingers, bribing the health department that not to vaccine their kids, but still show their kids as vaccinated in the paperwork.
Instead of fines and jail time, Askar adds, the government should focus on transparency and awareness campaigns.
You should address their concerns, give them facts, and share all the information which is available to the health department in a way which is understandable.
Some Pakistanis believe that vaccines are Western tools used to sterilize people. It didn't help that in 2011, the CIA worked with a local doctor to track down Osama bin Laden. The CIA wanted to confirm the DNA of bin Laden. That didn't happen, but they did gain crucial information that led to his assassination. Dr. Shahzad Beg leads Pakistan's polio eradication program. He spoke with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation last year.
At that time, it has a very negative impact on the populations. It is still in the mind of the peoples, although the magnitude of this has decreased tremendously.
But not completely. There's even been violence against some vaccine workers. Sayed Firouz Shah lost his cousin, Wajad Ali, who was a vaccine worker in 2019. Shah says his cousin was trying to convince a father to have his daughter vaccinated, but he shot and killed him.
Besides my cousin, he was my best friend. He believes in negotiating. He believes in communication.
When I spoke with Shah 2 years ago, he told me he wants the Pakistani government to do more to protect vaccine workers.
Mr. Wajid Ali sacrificed his life while he was saving the lives of the children of the nation.
It's unclear if the current bill will add to the backlash against vaccine workers. It is currently in the final stages of becoming law. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Officials in New York say the city cannot handle the rising number of migrants showing up there. Mayor Eric Adams describes it as an existential crisis.
We're getting 10,000 migrants a month. The city we knew, we're about to lose.
1,200 miles to the west in Topeka, Kansas, though, business leaders find themselves in a very different situation. They are reaching out to immigrants who've managed to enter the U.S. legally, offering to pay a select few up to $15,000 to come and live in Topeka. It's part of an expansion of a program focused specifically on immigrants from Latin America. Bob Ross is Senior Vice President of the Greater Topeka Partnership, and he's overseeing this project. Bob, what is the idea behind this relocation incentive program?
Topeka is growing at a pretty rapid rate from an economic standpoint. Our GDP has increased by about 20%. Our unemployment rate's at historic lows. But we are also, you know, keenly aware of the fact that, you know, we're in Kansas, we're a smaller state, and we are not necessarily front of mind for people as they're looking to relocate for jobs and opportunities. And so back in 2019, we created a program called Choose Topeka that was specifically designed to encourage people to consider our community for relocation. And it was developed in partnership with our businesses. So if you were able to get an opportunity with one of our participating employers, you can qualify for a matching incentive to relocate to the community for up to $15,000. And during the pandemic, we saw a significant number of people relocate to the community. And over the last 2 to 3 years, we've had about 118 families move to date. Now, one of the key parts of this program was also to make sure that we are reintroducing ourselves to a broader demographic. And we targeted the Latino community pretty early on because we have a strong Hispanic population that's historic in our city. Then there's also just a broad-based community effort to make ourselves more bilingual friendly and to begin to speak Spanish more effectively.
What can recipients use the money for?
It can be used for anything, frankly, for rent or housing purposes. They just have to complete a year of residency within the city. So the employer actually fronts the cost, and then we reimburse the employer 50%. Mm. And so that gives the employer a lot of flexibility in terms of how they leverage it. But that way, we're able to really connect potential applicants and really increase our pool, because Topeka's economy is very diverse. And so there's a lot of opportunities, either in the financial sector, the insurance sector, manufacturing, healthcare, you name it.
And how do you actually fund a project like this? You said 118 families have moved to Topeka. I mean, and they all receive $15,000?
Yeah, they can receive any variation of up to 15, depending on their income qualifications and everything else. We also receive a half-cent sales tax, and we have for over 20 years. Normally, that money has been used in a lot of communities around the country to attract brick-and-mortar, you know, rooftops to come to the city, a new distribution center, a new corporate campus. And we still do that work aggressively. But a couple of years ago, we decided, let's invest in people. Let's set money aside and really go after families to help support our existing employers. And sometimes we have to sweeten the pot a little bit to get people to consider us. And I think that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, especially in a community like Topeka, where the average home price is still around $160,000, getting, you know, $15,000 is a significant amount to be able to start a new life.
So Topeka is already diverse. More than a third of the city's public school students are Latino. Your mayor is a second-generation Mexican-American. Do you even need to offer incentives to attract more Latinos?
Topeka is a community. It was founded back in the 1850s by three groups, by, you know, abolitionists that came from New England, by freed slaves right on the eve of the Civil War, and by Mexican immigrants that came to build the railroad. And our Mexican immigrant community settled in a neighborhood called Oakland, centered around Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. And over the last 100 and some odd years have really, you know, developed a thriving Mexican-American culture here. And now we have new first-generation immigrants coming from all across Mexico and Central and South America. and they're finding the experiences and opportunities that they need to really enjoy life here.
I want us to hear, Bob, your group's director of equity and business development, Israel Sanchez. He was born in Cuba, in Havana, and he describes the city of Topeka as an attractive place for immigrants to relocate to.
I feel welcome here. I feel connected to the community in ways that I probably couldn't be connected in a bigger city, to be honest. There's a sense of community pride here that I definitely feel that connects all of us in a way that I haven't seen anywhere else.
Bob Ross, how big of a response have you seen so far? I mean, are you being bombarded with requests?
We have actually had, and we've been fortunate enough to have gotten a lot of people interested. And actually, Israel has been a champion for that community in helping to engage and connect with people. Is able, especially as a native Spanish speaker, he can talk to them and help to answer some of their questions. Really, over the course of the last 2 to 3 years, we've had over 4,000 people from around the world apply for the program.
Wow.
And so, especially if you're a migrant family, an immigrant family looking to start something new for your life, we're the only school district in the state of Kansas which offers full Spanish language immersion pre-K to 12, where any student, whether they're a native Spanish speaker or a native English speaker, can enter elementary school and graduate high school fully bilingual. Because in Topeka, we recognize really there's power in being bilingual in the future. And we want all students in our city and all people in our community to really own that opportunity and make them more competitive in a global marketplace.
I mean, one can imagine a lot of people wanting to take you up on this. How do you actually choose who gets to come?
So actually, especially since it's employer match, really our employers are the ones that really get to choose. And so we are creating a pipeline of talent and connecting them to employers. And then we're enhancing what our employers can do to really close the deal.
How are you reaching Latinos in Latin America?
So yeah, we've actually, you know, worked really aggressively on, you know, courting Spanish language media. We were fortunate to have Telemundo here all last week. We also are communicating in Spanish, making new videos that are Spanish language only.
Topeka isn't the only U.S. city to offer these kinds of incentives to select immigrants. There's a similar program in Baltimore and in Tulsa. How do these programs compare?
Yeah, I will say, you know, we were fairly early out of the gate. We're nimble because we are publicly funded. We have a foundation of finance that we can continue to monitor the trends and look for ways to engage new demographics and new groups as we go forward.
So, Bob, earlier we heard New York City Mayor Eric Adams talking about the pressure his city is under with too many migrants there. How do you account for the difference between some cities saying we've got too many migrants, we can't afford services for them, and Topeka saying we want more migrants and we'll pay you to come here?
I know. It is interesting to me. It is a little bit of a dissonant experience because nationally, there is a need for talent. And so, you know, I guess if you live in a community where you are fortunate to not and have all your talent needs met, maybe you'd be less interested in courting and talking to migrant communities. And so it is still a little interesting that some cities are saying, you know, no need to apply because we're definitely willing to welcome everyone here. It's one of those things where if you're in New York, I'd encourage people to, you know, open your doors and find opportunities because it's an incredible community of people. And the more I get to meet, especially those who have come from an international background, they have stories to tell. They have experiences that can add to the cultural experience of your community and can honestly make any community more vibrant and rich.
Bob Ross is the senior vice president of the Greater Topeka Partnership. He's been telling us about a program that pays immigrants $15,000 to relocate to Topeka, Kansas. Bob, thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Hey, great to meet you. Thank you much.
More global news still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. Police in Europe have been seizing huge quantities of one particular illicit drug produced and shipped across the Atlantic from Latin America.
Cocaine is a commodity today. It's a globally traded commodity for which there is massive, constantly increasing demand and availability.
The long spike in cocaine trafficking to Europe, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Outer space is so vast, it's almost incomprehensible to the human mind.
Space, the final frontier. To boldly go where no man has gone before.
But depending on where in space you're talking about, humans have gone there before, and we have left behind a lot of garbage. Space debris in Earth's orbit has been a problem for a long time. That debris can collide with satellites or space stations. Now the U.S. Federal Communications Commission has issued what is essentially its first ticket for littering in space, $150,000. The Dish Network got slapped for letting a satellite essentially die in a place where it could crash into other satellites. Carolyn Free is an associate professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Purdue University, and she has studied space junk. What exactly is the debris that the Dish Network is being fined for, Carolyn?
The debris they are fined for is their own satellite that reached its end of life. They didn't just leave it in place. They moved it, but they didn't move it far enough. So they were not following what they had submitted to the FCC as their end of life plan.
Yes. So the key thing here, it seems, is that the Dish Network could have dealt with the satellite in a responsible way, but they didn't. What should they have done?
We don't know all the details there. I think they tried to get to the graveyard orbit and they failed to reach that distance. So just before your satellite is decommissioned and goes dead, you make an end-of-life maneuver. So you use your thrusters in order to push you out there. So it's an onboard thing. That's also why we don't know what happened. So, I mean, they certainly tried to get out of the way. They didn't just switch off their satellite and said, good luck. So they certainly initiated that maneuver, or there were other reasons the maneuver was not successful.
Can you describe what the graveyard orbit is?
For objects which are outside the atmosphere, there's no natural mechanism to bring those objects down, even if it takes a long time. Objects in the geostationary ring are highly regulated. They have assigned slots because it's a very precious resource. Once they reach the end of life, it is the recommendation to move out of those slots and raise to a higher altitude of 300 kilometers above the geostationary ring to be well out of the way with the dead satellites.
Is this fine, Carolyn, a breakthrough in the world of space debris? I mean, has one ever been levied this large?
It is a breakthrough because although everybody is submitting their end-of-life plan for their satellites, so far there haven't been fines if you weren't following that. So this is the first ever fine, and this will have a ripple effect in the whole community.
Well, how crowded is it exactly up there?
Depends on which region you're looking at. So the space around the Earth is very crowded. We have done decades of spacefaring, and that has left a trace.
Right. And I mean, at what size does an object in Earth's orbit become dangerous?
Even small sizes are dangerous because of the large speeds those objects can gain. They are faster than a bullet leaving your gun.
Wow.
Small pieces will most likely not destroy your whole satellite, but if they pierce the battery, for example, then your satellite is not operational and becomes space debris itself. Larger pieces can completely obliterate an entire satellite.
Carolyn Free is an associate professor of aeronautics and astronautics at Purdue University. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
When people talk about fixing the climate crisis, one option you often hear about is the concept of carbon credits, a way to drive funding to initiatives that reduce carbon emissions. In recent years, though, carbon credits have earned a dodgy reputation. Today in our climate solutions segment, The Big Fix, the promise and peril of carbon credits.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, starts us off in the studio. So my basic understanding of carbon credits, Carolyn, it's an arrangement whereby someone pays someone else to do something that removes carbon from the atmosphere, right?
That's right. So say you fly a lot, but you care about the environmental impact of that. You can pay to buy a carbon credit to offset the emissions that result from your flight. And that money can go toward building a solar farm that will replace dirty coal energy on the grid, or very commonly preserving forests that would otherwise have been cut down so that the carbon stored in the forest's trees stays there. So you and I could buy these credits, but the big buyers are really businesses, which purchase these credits to offset offset emissions from their operations. And the market for these credits is expected to explode in coming years as more companies use them to offset emissions to reach net zero targets that they're setting for themselves.
So how many of these carbon credits are being sold right now?
Well, last year, the carbon credit market was valued at about $2 billion, and that was already four times higher than the year before. By 2030, it's expected to grow many times that large. Estimates range from about $10 billion to $50 billion by the end of the decade.
Wow. There are, though, a lot of problems with these credits, right? Some of which we've reported on over the years.
Yeah. One major concern is that some companies may be buying credits to avoid the hard work of actually cleaning up their own operations so that the credits are used as kind of a license to pollute. But if we're talking about the credits themselves, the voluntary market is unregulated, and there are many examples of credits not actually reducing pollution as much as they say they will or even at all.
Yeah, what are a few examples of where you've seen that?
One example is money from credits going to support renewable energy projects that experts say would have been built anyway, even without funding from these credits. Those types of credits underpin Delta Airlines' claim of being carbon neutral, according to a Bloomberg investigation. A very common problem with forest conservation projects specifically is that these credits purport to protect trees that probably wouldn't have been cut down in the first place. A study from August published in the journal Science found that out of 89 million carbon credits the scholars looked at, only 6% were actually linked to protecting trees and keeping carbon sequestered. Now, the carbon credit industry has realized that it has this credibility problem. It's established a task force that's come up with new rules for the industry to try to improve the quality of credits, but the problem is far from fixed.
Today, we've got a story on a somewhat different problem. It's not so much about whether carbon credits are preventing the carbon pollution they claim, but we're talking about how people are impacted on the ground. Carolyn, set that up before we hear the story.
So setting aside land for preservation to keep carbon in the ground, that's one thing. But what about the people who've used that land, often sustainably, for generations? That's another concern. What happens to these folks? And it's become a problem in Brazil. There's been a rush to claim land for these carbon credits, and it's impacting communities there, including one in the northern Brazilian state of Pará. The story we're about to hear was reported by Cicero Pedrosa Neto in Pará and Sam Shramsky. Here's Sam.
That's my reporting partner, Cicero Pedrosa Neto, arriving by boat to an island community in Curaçá, at the mouth of the Amazon River. It's part of a federally recognized conservation reserve.
Agora a gente já chegou do outro lado do rio e vamos seguir mais 7 km.
Pedrosa here is describing crossing the river to arrive at the spot where mangroves extend into the water. He's come to speak to Celia Regina das Neves, a fisher and local leader who uses resources from the forest, including palm fronds, in her everyday life.
Eu faço cestaria, faço matapi para minha pesca de camarão.
I make baskets, and I make traps for shrimping.
She also fishes among the mangroves. Das Neves, like many community activists throughout the Amazon, has grown increasingly concerned about carbon credits. Interest in them has grown since President Lula Inácio da Silva returned to power last year. Lula's administration has embraced carbon credits as a way to protect the Amazon and mitigate climate change while adding to the regional economy.
Para que a gente discuta uma política continental para preservar a nossa Amazônia e saber se esse famoso crédito de carbono existe mesmo.
Lula mentioned carbon credits as part of Brazil's path towards a bioeconomy, both at the COP27 climate conference shortly after being re-elected and again on a state visit to China.
A gente está chegando agora aqui na cidade de Curuçá.
Standing among the mangroves in Curuçá, Pedrosa describes how a company called Carbonext began speaking to local leaders here about allowing some of the reserve's mangroves and forests to be set aside for a carbon offset project. Recently, the reserve's president, José Roberto Garcia de Moraes, signed an agreement giving Carbonext authority to monitor area for the eventual sale of credits based off the carbon sequestered here on a piece of land the size of Detroit.
Porque vem agraciar todos nós.
It will benefit all of us, both the mangrove forest and the fishermen.
In a WhatsApp message, he argues once carbon credits start to be sold here, they will bring income to people who really need it.
Para nós, pescadores e costeiros,
for us, fishermen and coastal dwellers of our salty coastline, the project is important.
But according to Celia das Neves, the community as a whole wasn't informed and didn't agree with de Moraes' decision.
Isso não foi comunicado para as comunidades. As comunidades não têm conhecimento disso.
This agreement wasn't communicated to the community. Community members didn't know it was signed.
She sees the agreement as ceding the community's land.
Sem nenhuma reflexão sobre como isso se daria.
Without any consideration about how all of this would happen, if families would be allowed to continue fishing, if the crab catchers would be allowed to keep going down to catch their crabs. We don't know anything about any of this.
Eu penso que a pessoa que está à frente...
I think that the person in charge, the one who signed this terms of commitment document, was being pressured by Carbonex so that this all could happen.
In a letter responding to questions from the world, Carbonex said residents are always consulted about carbon credit projects, and there will be no restrictions on fishing or other activities in the reserve. It's hard to know with certainty where and how many offset projects there are in Brazil, because there is no official registry. This makes it difficult to monitor new carbon credit projects being designed and implemented in often remote, rural communities. Brazil's Congress is debating legislation for monitoring and enforcing these projects, but the very existence of voluntary carbon markets is unsettling to some researchers. Claudia Horn is a research fellow at the London School of Economics who has studied carbon credits in the Brazilian Amazon for years.
Of course, there is a lot of pressure from corporations to have a carbon market because they will be the prime beneficiaries of it.
But Horn feels there are better ways to reduce or sequester greenhouse gas emissions, conserve nature, and bring money to the region.
Strengthen the mechanisms that promote human rights and act against deforestation, right? Demarcation of indigenous lands, land reform, agrarian reform. All these are mechanisms that more directly have the positive effect on indigenous and traditional communities that are extremely poor.
Curuçá, meanwhile, does not appear to be an isolated case. In Brazil's Pará state, there are offset projects all over the place. In Munduruku, indigenous territory along the Tapajós River, local leaders report carbon credit companies trying to make inroads as far back as 2007. João de Deus Caba, a Munduruku leader, says it's only recently, though, that companies like Carbonex have been in constant, unsolicited contact, which most in his community have rebuffed.
So we don't want, we will not accept these types of contracts in the case of carbon credits.
Companies like Carbonex act as intermediaries between local communities, independent auditors, and the parties interested in offsetting their emissions in the first place. But because of the gray area they operate in, legal experts like Pedro Martins say they strong-arm community members into signing contracts. And once they have, Martins calls the contracts themselves abusive.
São contratos muitas vezes abusivos, porque eles interferem diretamente no uso do território.
They directly interfere with the use of the territory, and not just for a short period of time. It's not a question of 1, 2, or 3 years. Generally, these contracts are proposed for 30 years.
Martins says recently in one community, which he didn't want to name out of fear of retaliation, people weren't allowed to farm traditional lands after signing an agreement with a carbon credit developer.
Ou seja, até pequenos roçados...
Even small fields are often the object of persecution in these cases by these companies.
After facing criticism, Vera, the largest carbon credit auditor, is currently revamping its methodology in part to ensure locals still have access to their lands. In Curuçá, where my colleague Pedroza showed us around earlier, the lack of trust in carbon credit companies is palpable. 67-year-old Manuel Santana da Trinidade says the lack of free, informed, and prior consultation with communities is not acceptable, given how much territory and how many livelihoods are at stake.
It has to be discussed first with the community members, explain to the community the reason, the motive behind why they are coming here to offer these credits.
Walking along a path flanked by the reserve's tall trees and thick mangroves, Santana da Trinidade says he understands why the carbon they store is important internationally. But he says the fish and fruit harvested here, as well as the medicine and plant fibers, are important on a much more local scale. For The World, this is Sam Schramsky.
Cicero Pedrosa Neto co-reported the story from Pará, Brazil. Tomorrow, Wednesday at 2:20 Eastern Time, FEMA and the FCC will run a nationwide emergency alert test. It will trigger TVs, radios, and most importantly, cell phones to provide an emergency alert. By law, we cannot play the alert sound on air, but you can imagine the impact. Take this scene from the 1971 film Omega Man. Poor Charlton Heston, the last man on Earth, hears every phone in Los Angeles ringing simultaneously.
There is no phone ringing, damn it!
Seriously, though, the U.S. emergency system is designed to get our attention and give us information we need in a crisis.
Many people think of warning systems as the sort of siren, the alert that you get on your cell phone. But that's actually really the end of the process.
Corina Fernley is professor in warnings and signs communication at University College London. She says modern systems, like in the U.S., are designed to alert just the people who are at risk.
So, for example, if you're in New York, you don't necessarily want to hear that Mount St. Helens is now starting to do a bit of rumbling and we probably shouldn't go for a hike that day, right? That's not really relevant for you.
The US system is really good at this, but in other countries?
There are a limited number that do actually have this type of national warning system, partly because they are quite expensive to set up.
Fernley says another big issue is trust. There are places in the world where people may look at national alert systems with a degree of suspicion.
Even here in the UK, many people have opted out of having the cell broadcasting messaging, saying that, you know, they don't want the government to have their details, even though they don't have their details. So there's a lot of mistrust and misjudgment that can exist there.
20-some countries have a national alert system. Here's how Spain gets citizens' attention. And here's an emergency sound from Mexico. That one's an earthquake alert. Another now, a tsunami warning in Japan.
Tsunami desu.
Kind of inspires you to stay calm.
But of course, I think if you did that, perhaps here in the UK or over in America, people might be like, oh, well, I don't need to look at that message then. You know, it's got to be something to grab our attention.
Tomorrow, you can look forward to that. The nationwide emergency alert test will send a sound, a vibration, and a text to U.S. phones beginning at 2:20 Eastern. When Irish Special Forces rappelled from helicopters last week onto the deck of a container ship called MV Matthew, the operation exposed the scale of the illicit trade into Europe of cocaine. Around 150 million euros worth was discovered on board. That's roughly 2 tons. The amounts of cocaine being smuggled into Europe has been growing in recent years. Violent crime connected to the drug trade is on the rise in port cities, from Rotterdam to Barcelona, Marseille, and Naples. Generally, authorities are struggling to reverse the trend. Chris Dalby is a managing editor for Insight Crime, a think tank that covers the international drug trade. We reached him in Maastricht, the Netherlands. Can you give us an idea, Chris, of how big the cocaine trade is in Europe right now? Like, what sort of numbers are we talking about?
Absolutely. So while the seizure in Ireland was spectacular because you saw the special forces rappelling down the sides of the ship, those sorts of multi-ton seizures are almost commonplace on both sides of the Atlantic. And in well over a dozen European countries, you've seen record after record after record being broken, not just in the major port cities, so, you know, Antwerp, Rotterdam, Hamburg, but also in Portugal, also in Turkey, also in the Baltic states, in the Balkans. Cocaine is spreading through Europe at an increasingly fast rate. And you have dedicated, increasingly localized networks who have their contacts in Latin America to make those multi-ton cocaine deals. So we're talking about a very diversified criminal network in Europe that is facilitating the increase of the cocaine trade.
So the bust in Irish waters on MV Matthew was pretty spectacular. A large container ship, not small bales on tiny fishing boats. Is this what cocaine trafficking looks like nowadays?
It's what it's looked like for a fair number of years now. Container cargo ships are by far the most common way of smuggling huge amounts of cocaine from a number of container ports in Latin America, in the Caribbean, through West Africa, and into Europe. We did an investigation 2 years ago, and we found up to 11 places on a cargo ship, on an average cargo ship, where they could hide multi-tons of cocaine. So usually it's within the containers, but it was in the anchor compartment, it was where the propellers are, it was in the captain's cabin, in the water inlets, even in sort of fake torpedoes stuck to the outside of the ship where the ship didn't even know it was carrying cocaine.
Wow.
It is staggering, the inventiveness of drug traffickers.
So on this side of the Atlantic, we know about how certain drug kingpins and criminal gangs operate between the Americas. Does it work any differently in the transatlantic drug trade?
So it's actually interesting, and the Irish seizure is part of this. Starting 2 years ago, we hear rumors of what is a misnomer, but what's called a super cartel. There are allegations from Europol that drug traffickers from Ireland, Bosnia, the Netherlands, Morocco, and the United Arab Emirates from Dubai were forming a super cartel. That wasn't exactly true, but what was true was that all these kingpins who were running their separate outfits went to Colombia to talk to a group known as the Gulf Cartel to buy cocaine in bulk. So essentially, they were all placing these massive orders of cocaine for their own local distribution, buying it together, smuggling it across the Atlantic through the Panama Canal in massive shipments that was then to be broken up once it reached European shores. A couple of loads belonging to the super cartel were busted, but it seems they're still in business because that Irish load had all the hallmarks of belonging to the Kinahan cartel, which is the major Irish drug trafficking outfit, but on board were traffickers connected to a number of European destinations.
So cocaine still comes to the U.S., but has a lion's share since shifted to Europe and other parts of the world? I mean, is that where
Absolutely.
The big demand is?
It makes much more economic sense if you're a drug trafficker in Colombia or in Venezuela or in Ecuador or in Peru to make deals with Europe. There's still, don't get me wrong, a hefty cocaine market in the United States, but the share has been dropping. First of all, the price doesn't compete with Europe. It's increasingly easy to get those multi-ton shipments to Europe, even though it's much further. And also the rise of fentanyl has changed the dynamics of drug consumption in the United States. You would normally think of fentanyl and cocaine as appealing to two different customer bases, let's say. But fentanyl has now really sort of taken over for heroin in a lot of places and has had an impact because of its cheapness, its potency on the consumption of cocaine as well.
It has been evident in Mexico with the cartels, but with European trafficking of the drug, how much does it require the cooperation of corrupt public officials?
So within Europe, European outfits such as the 'Ndrangheta in Italy are, you know, generational legacy mafias who've been corrupting officials and police officers and judges for decades. And now controlling the transatlantic cocaine trade is part of it. What is interesting now is that because of the freedom of movement within the EU, if you're an Albanian trafficker and you get a permit to travel in the EU, you can go anywhere. We're seeing outfits from one country running entire drug trafficking, vertical integration drug trafficking scams in a completely separate country. In June or July, a network of Albanian drug traffickers, and Albanians are possibly the second most influential drug traffickers in Europe after the Italian mafia, were in Spain. They were in Ecuador making the deal. They were controlling the cargo loads to Spain. They were controlling the people getting the cocaine off the boat, the transportation within Spain, and then the distribution within Europe, all within one Albanian family clan, far away from their own shores in a country where they didn't necessarily speak the language, and yet a problem.
Chris, can law enforcement officials in Europe point to any successes in stopping the flow of cocaine into European cities?
There are successes. There is increasingly efficient transatlantic cooperation. There's a lot more intelligence sharing now that these networks are mapped.
Right.
2-3 years ago, Rotterdam, Antwerp, and Hamburg were where you were seeing almost all of the heavy seizures. And while those three ports still dominate, there's violence in Marseille, there's violence in Lisbon, there's violence in Gothenburg in Sweden, there's violence in Ireland, linked to these traffickers trying to find ways in through smaller ports.
Extraordinary knock-on effects there. What are the consequences of all this for the producer nations in South America where coca is cultivated?
So, interestingly, Colombia right now is really at a crossroads. Colombia, the president in Colombia, Gustavo Petro, is trying what he calls a total peace policy, where he's engaging in negotiations with over 20 armed and criminal groups in the country of all types. So your paramilitary and guerrilla groups that may have political leanings, and then overtly criminal drug trafficking outfits. He's trying to negotiate with them all in dramatically different circumstances and with dramatically different results to date. We wish him well. It's an incredibly difficult ask. It's an incredibly ambitious policy. I mean, you've got to see it in the same market economics as any legal commodity. Cocaine is a commodity today. It's a globally traded commodity for which there is massive, constantly increasing demand and availability. So when you have increasing supply and increasing demand, as you say, it's very difficult to see any way in which this stops. There is a growing awareness that the strategies of the past of killing or arresting the kingpins, ratcheting up the body count, and burning down or spraying coca crops from the air doesn't work. There's just too many ways around that. That sort of brutal intervention is factored into the cost of doing business for traffickers. And if one coca plantation goes up in flames, they'll plant three more.
Chris Dalby, the managing editor at Insight Crime, thank you very much for shedding light on how all of this works.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.